Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict appeals for an end to the violence in Iraq. The Vatican's envoy to the United Nations in Geneva gives his assessment of the fight against poverty and hunger. And a brother in Zimbabwe speaks out about the economic and humanitarian crisis in his country. Welcome to the programme. Speaking here in the Vatican on Sunday, Pope Benedict called on Iraqis as well as religious and political leaders worldwide to stop the violence between religious factions in Iraq that has cost the lives of countless innocent Muslims and Christians. During his Angelus address to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square, the Pope also sent greetings to Muslims worldwide, celebrating the end of their annual Ramadan period of fasting and prayer. His words came just after the Vatican released its annual message to Muslims for the end of Ramadan, drawn up by the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. My colleague Catherine Smybert takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Le notizie che provengono dall'Iraq.
After praying the Angelus prayer with tens of thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square, Pope Benedict expressed his solidarity with the Christian community and all victims of the violence in Iraq.
Moltissimi innocenti solo perché sciiti, sunniti o cristiani.
The Pope expressed his concern for the news coming out of Iraq on the very grave situation of insecurity and brutal violence to which many innocent people are subjected only because they are Shiites, Sunnis or Christians. He went on to appeal to the religious leaders and political leaders of the world and the local area to support those people on the path to reconstructing their homeland in the search of a shared balance, in mutual respect, and in the awareness that the plurality of its components is an integral part of its wealth. Pope Benedict added that he perceives the great worry that runs through the Christian community in the country and assured them of his closeness to them, as well as adding a call for strength and consolation for all. Christians make up just 3% of Iraq's 26 million people. The major groups include Chaldean, Assyrians, Armenians and Roman Catholics.
Rivolgo l'augurio di serenità e di pace.
The Holy Father also sent his cordial greetings to Muslims who are celebrating the holy Muslim month of Ramadan and wished them serenity and peace. It was Friday that the Vatican released its annual Ramadan message and called on Muslims to join Catholics in working to defeat terrorism. Monsignor Felix Machado is the Undersecretary for the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, which draws up the Church's message for the end of Ramadan each year.
The theme of this year's message to Muslims is Christians and Muslims in confident dialogue aimed at solving together the challenges of our world. The Church's dialogue has always been dialogue with people of other religions rooted in its own faith and tradition, never separate from it, never. And so all dialogue that the Church proposes, starting with Nostra Aetate, the declaration of the Second Vatican Council with regard to relationship of the Church with other religions, since the beginning and always the Church has maintained this equilibrium, so to speak, between being open to others but at the same time being rooted deeply into the integrity of the faith. And also the message to Muslims or to Hindus or to Buddhists that we send is always in this direction, that the Church is going out to dialogue, reaching out to dialogue with people of other religions because it is deeply rooted in the truth of its faith.
Also during his Angelus address, Pope Benedict XVI reflected on the fact that October 22nd of this year marked the 80th World Mission Day, as instituted by Pope Pius XI.
Today is Mission Sunday, a day of reflection on the call to spread the good news to all peoples.
The theme set by Pope Benedict for the occasion is charity, the heart of the mission. In his message, the Holy Father says that if mission isn't animated by love, essentially the love we find in Christ, it's reduced to mere philanthropic and social activity.
Let us support with our recognition and our prayers the men and women who leave home and family to preach the gospel. And may our own faith in Christ be renewed.
The Pope went on to say that mission always starts out from the heart transformed by the love of God, as testified to by countless stories of saints and martyrs who, in different ways, gave their life for the service of the gospel. Mission, he said, is therefore a place where there is room for all.
I wish you all a blessed Sunday.
And my thanks there to Catherine Smybert for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address this week. As the United Nations marks its 61st birthday this week, the outgoing Secretary-General, Kofi Annan, gives a realistic assessment of the most serious problems still facing our planet. On the positive side, over the past decade, he says, debt relief has increased, many civil wars have ended, and the world is scaling up its response to the AIDS crisis. Yet the gap between rich and poor continues to grow, he notes, and very few countries are on track to reach the Millennium Development Goals on decent living conditions for all. Many people still face atrocities and repression. The nuclear question requires urgent attention, while terrorism and the reaction to it are spreading fear and suspicion. During his decade-long tenure as head of the UN, Annan has focused much attention on urging countries to fulfil the Millennium Development Goals drawn up by world leaders 6 years ago. They include the goals of eradicating extreme poverty and hunger, reducing child mortality and maternal health problems, achieving primary education for all, and combating diseases like AIDS and malaria. Yet even the most optimistic assessments show that many of the poorest countries are unlikely to come anywhere near achieving these goals.
I think we have to start with one fact, that most of the African countries south of the Sahara will not meet any of the Millennium Development Goals.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva.
I think that's a kind of red light of alarm that should make us reflect why in Africa and in other continents there is this reality of extreme poverty or simple poverty, because 1 billion people live with less than $1 a day, and 2 billion people live with less than $2 a day. So there is a huge gap between rich and poor in the world still now, notwithstanding enormous efforts made in terms of direct aid for development, giving cash for development to some governments, and also some transfer of technology and know-how. So some of us are looking at this panorama around the world, and the data that are provided by the agencies of the United Nations, because some of the most interesting information is given to us by the UN Commission for Trade and Development, or by the World Bank that is somehow related to the United Nations. And on the basis of the very information provided by these agencies, we can see that there has been some kind of a failure in bringing out of poverty most of the world. Now, it's interesting that through the process of liberalization of trade and the globalization of the markets, in the last few years, some 300 million people, especially in China and India, have been moved out. They have graduated, so to say, out of poverty into a more acceptable lifestyle. But what is that compared to the huge numbers that are still in poverty? I think it's a positive achievement that probably points out the road we need to follow in order to help other people to get out of poverty.
Let's look at that road. What is it that has been achieved in these countries that isn't being achieved in Africa?
I'm not an economist, but from listening carefully to what the ambassadors from the developing countries are saying, to what they have to say, and reading the information that is provided by the different agencies of the UN system, and trying to really also reflect on my own experience in Africa and in some other countries, I think that we can kind of highlight certain priorities. One is that in the countries that are moving forward in the improvement of their economy, there is a core base of people well-educated, so that in today's world that is very much depending on knowledge-based economy, the requirement of education is very fundamental. So where there has been work for some years on educating people, taking them out of illiteracy, then this has created like enough of a base from where to take off, to have qualified workers, to have reliable people, to have persons that can handle simple technology and so forth. A second observation is that the family structure is also a very important element in the economy. For example, in Asia, for all the criticism that may be labeled against some of the countries for whatever political approach they adopt, the family structure is pretty much a solid, normal kind of functioning unit of society that creates dependence in the sense that people can depend on this kind of structure. And second, that it's a reliable point of reference in case of emergency, so that it's a joint venture in addressing economic achievement, so people can work very hard, long hours, and they are supported by the family structure. So that's another interesting angle. And then there has been an opening of the market. I think we have to consider and accept this fact as an important dimension of economic progress. China, for example, in the last 20 years has decided to become part of the world network of trade. It opened its markets to investment from outside, with certain controls, to be sure, but it's an opening. And in this way, we have seen that all along the eastern coast of China, there has been an incredible progress. However, there is a caveat. There is a caution that needs to be introduced. In China, 300-400 million people enjoy a very good life. They are a part of this boom of the market. But then we have probably another 600 million people who are in the backwaters of China that have still a lifestyle that is very much without some basic assistance in terms of health, education, and so forth. So we need to balance these things. But as part of the important ingredients for a movement forward to uplift people out of poverty, I think the opening of the liberalization of markets is very essential. On the other hand, you know, globalization and liberalization of markets is not enough in itself. I think we need some rules and some fairness so that the results of the increased wealth obtained through this kind of process, the result may be a more even spreading of the benefits. Otherwise, we have a Wild West kind of economy where you have an objective increase in wealth, but you don't have more people participating in this benefit and having their lifestyle improved.
Thank you.
The Church has long been concerned with promoting global solidarity alongside a globalization of the markets, urging wealthy nations to give more generous development aid and promote a fairer system of international trade. Yet despite debt relief and an increase in aid to the poorest nations, many of these countries are simply not seeing improved living conditions for the majority of their people. Archbishop Tomasi says it's vital to address problems of corruption and wastage in both donor and recipient countries.
Last year, the international community gave $50 billion for development, one way or the other. $20 billion went to consultants. So there is something that does not click right away. But I think there is a lot of goodwill in some countries to bring their contribution for development up to 0.7% as they had committed themselves some time ago. Not many countries have reached that goal, but there is a movement upward in terms of the percentages contributed. And this is a component that is necessary because some of the poor countries need cash and need this kind of assistance in order to move forward. To make this direct contribution, be it in cash or be it in technology or know-how forms, you need to have a counterpart. We must also look at the other side of the medal. Corruption is a choker of development, and it stifles possibilities of growth in many poor countries. And we need to talk more about it. We need to address this issue in a more forceful way. Also because some of the money that is lining the pockets of some leaders or some corrupt figures ends up in Europe, and it ends up in the banks that are quietly supporting a system without obviously explicitly planning to do this, but are supporting a system that is against development. So we need to work at the point of arrival of the help that is given.
Greater transparency,
fighting corruption, greater transparency, facilitating private property. I know in some countries there is still a reluctance to give ownership of the land to the people or to make them at least secure enough in their piece of land that they are managing to stimulate creativity and to encourage them to produce more, to save, and to begin to generate an economic system that begins to function. So we need to balance things. And at the same time, we need to examine on the part of the rich countries all the pledges that have been made along the years to cancel debt, to contribute more in a more organized and a more coordinated way, assistance for development, to coordinate also in terms of the relationship between what international agencies are doing and individual states are doing. So there must be a convergence, so not that one ignores what the other is doing, or sometimes funding the same project or creating this type of confusion.
Money being wasted, in other words.
There is a need to create a tighter dialogue between the people and the donors, so that the priorities are determined by the receiving people and the donors can control.
Thanks there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. And finally, food shortages affecting more than 1 million people, a severe AIDS epidemic. 70% unemployment, and the world's highest inflation rate, currently running at over 1,000%. These are just some of the problems faced by Zimbabwe's 12 million people. Urban residents have also been contending with burst sewers, water shortages, and intermittent power cuts, which have fanned fears of more political unrest. Zimbabwe's economic and humanitarian crisis is often blamed by many critics on President Mugabe's government. However, Mugabe, who has ruled the country since independence, rejects charges of misrule and blames the crisis on Western sanctions imposed after allegations of political repression. Elphas Khoza is a religious brother who recently returned to his native Zimbabwe after spending several years studying in Italy. He talked to my colleague Susie Hodges about the current situation in his homeland.
Infrastructure-wise, almost everything is destroyed, and the services are very poor. You can't just get anything you want, even if you have the money. And for the poor man, he cannot live in Zimbabwe because there is nothing, there is no work. What he sells on the street is taken away by the police, and everything is expensive. Living is expensive. To be poor is expensive. So disappointing. It's not good.
And how do you find the morale of the people?
It's divided. Some people, they're just given in. They despair. And some people are still fighting. And you find that some people, they are hoping to leave the country to go to some other places. Some, they leave because they're afraid of being killed. Some, they leave because they're looking for work. They've despair, most of them. And no one was willing to stand up and call on the government.
Would you say there's an atmosphere of fear then? People are frightened to criticise things too openly?
Yes, they are afraid. They're afraid because, you see, if someone stands up and challenges the government, you remain alone. People won't join you. So it makes people afraid because you will die alone and no one will be with you. So your death is pointless.
Zimbabwe has a grave humanitarian crisis. You know, people are dying because of AIDS, they're dying because of hunger. Just how serious is this humanitarian crisis? What evidence do you see of it around you?
Very clear, because if you look at the people who were displaced by the Operation Mrambatswina, you find that those people, they have no income, they have nothing, they are poor. So you find that there is no other thing they can do but to be together. There's no work, they're always together. Malnutrition, and then if you add AIDS, they cannot fight, the body is weak. So, humanly speaking, you cannot survive in such a situation. The government does something, and you are poor. There's nothing, you cannot survive. It's very bad. And at the same time, you find the government is closing down these NGOs who are trying to help. The policies are so bad.
In fact, a politician recently said that the humanitarian crisis is very grave, yet it seems that Zimbabwe's problems are off the world's radar screen, that people aren't taking notice of the fact that there's so many people that are suffering there. Do people there feel that the outside world has forgotten about Zimbabwe's plight?
Yes, to some extent, but I think you remember the disturbances in Israel and those things, they took away the attention from Zimbabwe. And it seems like at the moment, the people believe that the world is saying Zimbabweans are the ones who are going to correct their problems. We are not involved. There's a sense of we are abandoned, even in the African society. There isn't much care about Zimbabwe. People talk about it, but nothing is being done.
And I gather that Zimbabwe has one of the lowest life expectancies in the world nowadays, that, you know, women are dying in their mid-30s. Is this the case?
Yes, people die young, but not everyone is dying. I think the statistics, they just looked at the situation at the moment. Yes, people do die, but it's not that we can say everyone dies at that age.
Zimbabwe has one of the highest inflation rates in the world. It's currently running around 1,200%. How is this impacting on people in their daily lives? Can you tell us, you know, just how it affects you and other people living in Zimbabwe?
Oh, it affects us a lot. And talking about the inflation, and it is expected to be by 400, 4,000 and something percent next year, the inflation. For a poor man who earns his money today, if you don't spend it today, after a week, it's useless. You can't buy anything because you cannot put it in the bank. But also the problem with that, we have electricity off-cuts, so you can buy like things like meat sometimes. They might go bad. So you are caught up in a situation where you cannot keep many things in the house and you cannot find everything in the shops in time.
And what about the petrol shortages? Does that impact upon people?
Yes, a lot. Because that's what raises the prices in the shops. Petrol is expensive, but the government said they are reducing or bringing down the fares in the transport sector. But it doesn't help. It impacts a lot, fuel. Fuel is one of the commodities that is very expensive and it's difficult to just get it.
When it comes to the role of the Catholic Church in general in Zimbabwe, how do people view the church? Is it respected? You know, tell us something about its role and what it's doing and how it's looked upon by the people.
The church is respected in my diocese, and the people. The church is the only hope for the people because it's the one that is the only one that is caring for the people. That it has the people in its mind. It's working for the people.
You talked about the fact that many people are leaving the country. Is it felt that there is a bad brain drain from Zimbabwe at the moment?
Yes, very severe, yes. Yes, people are leaving. You can't work in the country and then you earn nothing. People have a lot of needs that cannot be met in Zimbabwe and they have the skill. They can't be employed anywhere else, so they leave. So that's why I was talking about the services, that the services are very poor. Because manpower is gone. The brains of Zimbabwe have gone.
The government says that some of the reason for Zimbabwe's economic crisis is the drought and Western sanctions. Is this felt that this is a fair view?
It's not fair. The government makes policies. I wouldn't blame someone else for my own mistakes. The government has its own mistakes, but it has to correct before it blames other people.
President Mugabe, however, claims that the economy is on the mend.
No, it's not on the mend. No, there's nothing like that. We cannot produce things ourselves, and there's nothing. We cannot mend the economy. We're producing nothing.
But is it a very divided country between government supporters and opposition supporters?
At the moment, you can't see that. There's less fighting at the moment. You can't pick it out. But you know people are afraid. It's a bit subtle, underground.
How do people there in Zimbabwe, yourself included, feel about the country's future?
Well, it will take time to heal. But I still feel the people, they love the country. And if they love the country, they're going to correct the situation at one point.
Susie Hodges there talking to Elphas Khoza, a religious brother from Zimbabwe. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. We'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.